Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speakers are Jeff and Emily Kirsten-Greep. Today they will be continuing their series on communication and gender. Today's session number is 2 and is titled, Words Make the Woman and Man. Let's listen in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yay! What a group. How many of you were here yesterday? Show us.
Oh, great.
We were actually next door.
Thank you, Neil. How many of you were next door yesterday? But even though very many of you were with us yesterday, we thought it'd be a really nice way to start today if you could turn to the person on your right and shake their hand. We'll demonstrate. For those of you who are new today, my name is Jeff Kirsten-Greep, and I'm a teacher of speech communication at the University of Washington, or Washington, depending on what part of the country you're from. I know where SQIM is, Bible study today, and I've been teaching that stuff for about 12 years. I've also taught at the University of Puget Sound. I teach communication in a bunch of different contexts, like interpersonal, small groups, public communication, gender communication, all that kind of stuff.
Speeches.
Speech, as we like to say. I teach speech.
I'm Emily Kirsten-Greep.
We're married.
That's the only way you'd get a name that long. And I'm a social worker in Tacoma, Washington. I work with an organization called First Place for Children. I work as a family support specialist. I'm also a supervisor of staff, but work with families where abuse and neglect have taken place with children within families. I think about communication a lot in terms of children and in terms of families because that's who I work with, and gender's a very important piece of that. So Jeff disappeared. I feel exposed. This seems bigger than yesterday. I don't know. Somehow it's like this.
Should I come stand with you?
You might want. No, I'll be fine. Thanks. I am going to stand up while I talk. Today, I want to do a couple of things, and then Jeff and I sort of split it today along gender lines. No, not really. But what I want to do real quickly is just a two-sentence review of what we did yesterday so people have some sense of that. Then I'm going to talk today about the sources of where we get our gendered identities. It's going to be brief. We're not going to do this real long. We have so many things we want to talk about, and we know you want to talk about, that we're going to try to move quickly. So I'll apologize in advance if you want to say a lot. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this piece. Then we're going to do an exercise that I think you'll all really enjoy. It's an interesting way of looking at how we categorize one another by gender. Then we're going to Jeff then is going to talk about communication because he's the communications guy. We're going to talk about what does that mean in, you know, sort of where the rubber meets the road. So today we're going to be talking about those three pieces, and I think this morning's Bible study, how many went to this morning's Bible study with Les? Yeah, his talk about language. We both just sat there going, wow, yeah. Wow, you know, language is so important, and how we say things and why we say things. The words we use really matter, and maybe not as much as the ancients, but they certainly matter, and they count, and we need to think hard about them. So we're going to be talking about that today. So that was a long introduction.
That's great.
just to review real quickly, yesterday one of the distinctions we made is that we're not talking about biological or physical sex here. We're talking about gender, and that gender is something that we learn, we're taught, and we learn through our culture. And so that's kind of the distinction we want to have there. We talked about what it means in our society to be masculine and feminine. People broke into groups and talked about that. We talked about what some of the studies have said. And it's all very interesting and very fun, and we can talk about that more one-on-one, as always. But we're going to just keep moving today. What I want to talk about today are the sources of where we learn about, or where we learn our genders. The three I'm going to pull out and talk about from my reading are family, teachers, and peers. There's media. There are a million things. We talked about whether we wanted to include a media discussion. What we felt like is, you know, media often is kind of the whipping boy, and I probably am the prime person. I'm probably as appalled as anyone at what media does about gender and the messages we get about gender. But what we were feeling like as we did our reading and thought about it is that these are three things that we interact with in a way where we feel like we have a little more control over what happens. Sometimes media is so, it's so prevalent and it's so out there that we don't feel like we have as much control over it, whereas these are things we do. So what I want to do real quickly is just talk about a couple of the things that we get from family, teachers, and peers. I'd like to give people a chance to maybe give one or two examples. We're going to spend about 10 minutes on this and then keep going. One of the things I think that's important to remember is that in all three of these, the things we learn about our gender and what's acceptable within our gender, according to the reading I've done and the studies I've seen, is that it's much more rigid for men than it is for women. And that carries across in all of these examples. Fathers have a more rigid idea of how their sons can and cannot behave. Teachers have real clear different expectations of boys and girls in the classroom, and it's much more narrow for how a boy can behave. Peers, male peers are much harder on one another about what's acceptable and what isn't if you're a boy. So that's a more rigid thing. I'm just going to list a few things real quickly about what we get from our parents. Number one, our parents don't give us conscious messages very often. Someone gave a good example yesterday of one that was very conscious, you know, about how you, a mom telling a daughter that you let the guy think he's figuring it out on his own, but you do it this way. But most of it's unconscious. Most of it is their modeling. And the main, you know, I mean, that is your primary place that you learn what it means to be male and, or feminine and masculine, and what is a relationship between a man and a woman look like for children who grow up in a family that has a man and a woman as parents. But also they their attitudes are going to reflect I'm looking at notes and making myself confused. The way they communicate what your role is often is in the choice of toys that they get for you. Little girls, they did a survey and went into three-year-olds' rooms, the bedrooms of three-year-olds. They had parents let them in. The toys were distinctly different. Boys, you know, had the blocks and the trucks and the, you know, real sort of things that build on scientific and analytic thought. Girls had dolls, dresses, makeup, you know, a lot of those sorts of things early on. The other thing that Jeff and I talked about being interesting is when they look at families, one of the main things that happens, even in parents that both spend quite a bit of time with their kids, is that moms do the day-to-day stuff and dads play. Dads are playmates. I hear lots of people laugh. Is that a common experience? Dads do the fun things. They take you to the zoo, or you go get donuts together, or you go do something together. But moms are there when you need your diaper changed and you need, you know, or you have a crisis with a friend or whatever. So that's the difference. Do people have some examples of, you know, I'd like to get one or two, of how they think their parents helped influence their gender identity? I think I'm coming at this maybe.
Pretty hard. Well, I've been here 5 minutes, asked to talk already.
What kind of chores we were given.
That's a good
one. I have a twin brother, and he took out the trash, and he helped mow the yard, and I washed the dishes and was told that I couldn't go mow the yard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yours were the indoor, closed-in things, because right. We're outdoor, expansive, physical. Anything else?
Yeah. My experience growing up on a farm, I guess, was the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. I got to do outdoor chores.
You probably would have rather not, huh? Yeah, I think that's often true in families where the family's work
I
is
also,
shared.
I don't think had these rigid gender models. Mm-hmm. I grew up thinking I could do anything in the world if I was willing to put the effort in to prepare mm-hmm. for that.
That's great.
And that was a good long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can I interject?
Yeah.
This mirrors what you were saying yesterday. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, yeah. That was one of the things we brought up yesterday, is that families in the cultures where you work together, like the family's work is the family.
Mostly agrarian.
Include agrarian and things like that, that those gender roles aren't as divided.
But I couldn't milk cows because my mother's mother taught her that was not woman's work.
Oh, really? That's a funny one. That's a good one. Well, let's keep moving because we didn't want to spend too much time on this. Teachers, again, schools really reinforce stereotypes of gender roles in the studies that they've done. I think a lot of you have probably seen some of the studies come out about how there's very unequal attention paid to girls as opposed to boys in the classroom. That one of the things, I was just looking at this again last night, that it's especially negative for African-American males and African-American females, that it's sort of even more negative in terms of attention and attitude about those students, and that it's little wonder that there's the dropout rate. The other thing that was interesting is that if you look at self-esteem in girls and boys, the longer you're in school, the more it goes up if you're a boy. The longer you're in school, the more it goes down if you're a girl. So it's a real scary thought, and I think something real important to think about for teachers is how do we look at that. And one of the cartoons I've always just loved is that it's a Doonesbury cartoon, and I can't remember, it was Joni had the little girl,
yeah.
And I don't remember her name, but she's sitting in a classroom and the teacher says, "What season is it?" And her hand's up, and she says, "You know, Bobby," and Bobby says, "You know, it's spring," and then she said, "What month is it?" And her hand is up, and she says, "It's Joey," and he says, "It's April," and then she said, "What day of the week is it?" or something, and her hand is up, and she calls on a boy, and then one more question, and her hand goes up, and she says, "What? No one, you know, I need to hear from some of you others, Ronnie, Bobby, Jerry," and the little girl in little dots above her head says, "Gee, maybe I should lose some weight."
Yeah.
It's like, I wonder what's wrong, you know, my hand doesn't show in here. But the studies say that's true, which is disappointing. But now I give you all that and then say, do you have any examples? But does anybody have an example of how school helped do that?
When we were in particular junior high and high school, the boys had to take, it was a required course that they take shop, and the girls had to take home ec.
That's right.
And
that's right.
And you couldn't, a girl couldn't take shop and he couldn't take home ec.
And speaking as a boy, he wouldn't want to take home ec.
That's right.
That was the scary thing when I was there in the mid-70s.
Yeah, that's
but even in the 50s, there were some boys that took some cooking classes in my junior high.
They called it bachelor arts.
Well, no,
they did. That's
but
what
we
they
still didn't
it.
Take. We didn't take shop.
Right. Yeah.
This is indirect, but this is in my math class. The guy that teaches the class is a very good math teacher. Plastered all over four walls and the ceilings are posters of male sports stars, not a single female sports star. And I've always wondered what that said to the girls in this classroom.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, good examples. Peers. This one, of course, I think probably anybody who's a parent in the room thinks about a lot, and probably any of us thinking back to our own experience think about a lot. I mean, it's an incredibly strong influence, and it gets stronger the older your child gets, from five almost on. I'm sure parents feel that sense of kind of losing their child to culture in a way that they don't have as many. We are adopting a little girl who's coming to our family at three, and she already, she knows all the Disney characters, which include Pocahontas, who's, you know, really shaped like no one on earth, and, you know, all these things. But, I mean, she's already steeped in some of these things, and thinking about how that's all going to work out is very interesting. But her peers at school play those games. You know, we went to a face painting thing the other day and they had a Batman, and she said, "Anthony, Batman, I want a Batman on my face." You know, I was like, "Oh, rats, Anthony." You know, but again, the rigidity for boys. Let's see. And just basically what they say is that boys teach each other to be controlling and competitive, while girls teach each other to be cooperative and kind. And one of the things they also say that I think is a pretty interesting point in our society as it is now is that peers are more important to boys And there are a lot of reasons for that. Some of them, you know, some of the reasons that have been given have been, you know, that psychologically, because boys have to separate from, you know, the primary caregivers, the mothers, so they have to separate. So, you know, they have to go find this male figure, and if the father's working and out of the home and not there, they're just, you know, out there looking, and peers are more available to them than adult male figures in society as we're now put together. So that's one theory. But girls, because they can stay more closely attached to their primary caregiver, their mother, it's sort of Freudian, but because we can stay more attached to our mothers, that we don't quite need to attach as strongly to our peers. And so, but it does seem to be that boys are more influenced by peer groups than girls. Does anybody have stories about peers, like what your peers expected, what they... Yeah.
I was across from Narnia this morning, and they were going out for a hike, and I heard someone say, you're not a boy, but that's all right.
Was it a kid or one of the teachers?
I couldn't tell.
But that's all right. Yeah, anybody else would, you know, your own influence of peers or, experience?
There was lots of reinforcement on that. If you're not pretty or if you're not really fine motor skilled, in the gymnastics area, Rosemary's because in gymnastics you weren't real well coordinated, the girls would ostracize you. So even though all that reinforcement for being pretty and being the cheerleader.
I think we're all really aware of the strength of that one. So now, I'm going to segue over. I'm not going to spend any more time on that. I just think it's important to have in our heads where this comes from. I mean, we grow up with it. It's all around us. Jeff will be talking about languages being part of that, too. But that our families really were immersed in it from the days we're born.
Can I say a word before you start?
Yeah.
I want to emphasize, as we move from here to here, that it's not magic. Like, if Neil is my child, he doesn't get how to be masculine by me just sort of... sending him thoughts, that there's a real practical means by which, these are the sources of messages about gender, this is the means by which we do it. And what we're moving into now is a notion that this, when you're communicating, you're not just sort of picking up a brick and using it, or picking up a little hammer and using it. It's like you're reaching in, you expect to get a hammer and you get a train, you know, and you didn't know that the thing was going to take you here. That language has something to it that's not real passive, that's powerful. And what we're going to do next, I think, will tap that a little bit.
Could I make a comment before we go on?
Sure.
This is true, but there's another part. I'm a mother of a female, and she's my only child. And when she was two, I got her a truck, a big truck. I thought, we're not going to have gender bias. We're not going to buy Barbie dolls. We have a truck. Well, what she did is she extricated the truck driver, and she rocked him. My man. And this is what she did, and she never played with the truck. So that's what we mean, is something very inbuilt as well about gender.
But I also think, that little boys, working with lots of young children for a long time now, I think there are a lot of little boys who, if they weren't as influenced by what they're told they should want to do and like to do and enjoy, who would also like to pick up that little person and rock them. But I have parents of 1.5-year-olds who worry if their children aren't doing what they consider appropriate play in a child care setting. And, you know, that's a real, I think that just because, you know, I think it's anecdotal more than innate. That's my take, but I'd really be happy to continue that conversation, because it is. I mean, now I'm raising a daughter who likes to wear pink, you know, it's like, oh geez, but she doesn't like to have her hair in ponytails. So.
She's just ecstatic about Barbies, too. We have no idea where this came from. That's, to respond also to that, think about cultures, too. Freud said anatomy is destiny. We heard a couple people talking yesterday about, you know, talk some more about nature and that we really are called as men and women to do things. Then how do we explain cultures where the sexes do opposite of what we do in our culture. Some of the cultures Margaret Mead studied, for example, where the men are the decorative, passive, domestic, nurturing ones, and the women are the more aggressive, all the things we associate with males in our society. How can that be if it is just a hardwired thing?
And also,
I think one of the problems, though, when we talk about possibly some differences between male and female at birth is that when we talk about it, we go to the point, like you say, hardwired or deterministic, and it's not necessarily deterministic, and nobody says that it's deterministic, or some people say that it's deterministic.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you say, well, I can't fathom that because I'm not going to think of gender being deterministic because that goes against my belief, but it's not necessarily true that because there is something nature to us that is necessarily deterministic. So you can have variances, and you can run the gamut. It doesn't, nature doesn't mean deterministic, and
right.
I think that's a
right. Which
point.
I think was part of our point yesterday about our sex can certainly have an influence on things, but it isn't.
It does.
It's not us. It's not. And the other perspective we haven't had here yesterday or today, and I don't know if anybody wants to bring it in, is the gay and lesbian issue about those gender questions. And I actually talked to somebody this morning who was not certain they would be welcome to bring that point in, so we'll be sure to include that point more coming days. But anyway,
you clearly tapped into our political agenda here.
Right.
We hope to have you leave with is a sense of how much control you have over your gendered identity and how much control, to some degree, you have over other people's gendered identity through this really powerful thing that we do with each other, languaging.
Yeah.
And that it's not all this and it's not all the other, but obviously I'm biased in the language direction because I want you to leave here feeling like you can do something.
Are you familiar with that study of nurses in the hospital when the babies are just born and the blue blankets and the pink blankets? And they did a study where the nurses pick up and rock and cuddle the babies that are in the pink blankets a lot more than they do in the blue blankets. And so a lot of these things are very subtle from day one.
And that we talk to girl babies more.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
A lot more. And it might be because women identify more with a female baby, we're not sure, but female babies get talked to a lot more. But we should go on.
Keep interrupting me.
Okay, I'm going to keep it moving just so we have time to do the exercise and we've got a lot to do. The exercise we're going to do is one where I'm going to split you. Oh, there it is. I'm sorry. I'm going to divide you into men and women. So we're going to put women on. I'm going to continue to have women on the left because I always go left given the option. And we'll put men on the right.
Because men are right.
We're more conservative, as we can. But I'm going to do that, and I'm going to tell you what we're going to do first. I'm going to ask each group to come up with names or words that refer to the opposite sex. Okay? And, you know, they don't have to necessarily be names that you use, but names that you understand. You know, it's like you would understand if somebody called a woman a fox. You'd know, even if you've never called a woman a fox, that's a word you know pretty much what the person would mean if they said it. And we're going to have one person in each group write those down, and we're only going to have 10 minutes. Oh, boy. 10 minutes? It's 5 till.
That's okay.
Okay, 10 minutes to do it, which includes getting yourselves into opposite sides and stuff. I'll go over with the women and
you have to know your sex to do this.
That's right. Check. The one thing we couldn't decide is, I think what I do want to say is you can avoid or include profane ones as you're comfortable. We weren't sure what to do with that. I don't want to offend anybody. At the same time, I think it's important to understand that there are words that are quite profane.
When we do this with collegiate audiences, those are usually the first words that you hear.
So, you know, I don't know that we're going to write those on the board or even say them out loud. We'll decide what we want to do with that. But,
come up with as many as you can think of.
That sounded wonderful. I'm really anxious to hear the rest. Jeff's going to take it from here. And thanks. It's been fun so far. are, and I can't wait to hear how this catches.
We're going to take apart the exercise in a minute. What I want to do first is to make a couple points about language and about communication so that maybe there'll be some richness to the debriefing that we do about the list that you come up with. I will tell you that you'll be trading lists so that you'll get to see the list generated for you by some representatives of the opposite sex, not necessarily the opposite gender. The point I want to make is that there's more than one way to look at language, and I'd like to have you leaving here today understanding that this is a really powerful way to look at language, and I'll talk more about what it means to look at language as soup. And that when you're communicating, you're doing a lot more than just sharing information with another person. That you're doing a lot of other things too that are much more subtle, and maybe it becomes more obvious how these messages about gender actually get from one person or group of people to another person or another group of people. Through all sorts of mundane kinds of communication. I think this is how most people think of language. Language is a system of symbols that represent things. The symbol dog represents this thing that goes arc, right? I mean, that's pretty clear. But then you look at symbols like angst. What does that represent? Don't know. So there are some things about language that aren't represented. When you think about language as a system of, as just a system of symbols, there's some stuff that gets left out. So another way to look at language is to think of it as sort of a game or an activity, and that words don't represent things sometimes. Sometimes words do things. When you marry someone, you stand up there with that person and you say, "I do." That doesn't represent your commitment. That is your commitment. When you say, you know, "Lend me $10, I'll pay you back," you're doing something with that utterance. You're doing something with those words. They don't represent something necessarily. They're doing something. So if you look at language as an activity, that helps you see even more of what language does. For our purposes, looking at language as a soup helps us see some ways that language maybe controls us as much as we control it. If you think about language as a soup, this gets back to something Wes was talking about this morning in Bible study and how the Greeks respected language and thought of it as very powerful. That words matter, and not just words, we'll talk about communication in a minute, but words matter. How you choose to talk to another person and address another person really carries some weight with it. Words have baggage. We give words baggage. My grandmother charitably has described me as slim for most of my life. Students sometimes have described me in other terms that also are less neutral terms. And when I say neutral, I think you know what I mean. Can you think of some more pejorative terms that you might use to describe a slim physique?
Scrawny.
Oh, that's my favorite. How would you describe someone if you wanted to compliment them and they were slim?
Lean.
This is great. This is such a nice church going audience. You had so many of those that just came out of your mouth. For wiry, that's the one I would like to be wiry. But the point here, when you think about language as a soup, a radical way of thinking about this is that unless we have words for something, we can't know it. We can't understand it. We can't see it in effect. I grew up in Minnesota, and one of the things I've learned since being in Washington, I've been teaching now the whole time I've been there, which is 12 years, and there is a real big Asian population out where I am. And when I first got there, and still to some degree, I have a hard time telling apart a Burmese from an Indonesian person, from a Japanese person, from a Chinese person. In Minnesota, I didn't care. Oh, they're Asian.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I saw. I'd see a whole bunch of people from, you know, a whole quarter of the world, and I'd see them as all pretty much the same, because I couldn't draw the distinctions. A more simple example might be in Minnesota. I don't remember much of a distinction in rain. They say, rain changing to thunderstorms? Isn't that kind of what they'll talk about, occasional thunderstorms? You move to Seattle, and we get so much rain that we draw distinctions. You listen to the news and the weather. What do they say? Rain changing to
shower.
And what the heck is that? Oh, just changed. Now it's a shower.
Light shower.
But after you've been there a while, you know. You're out and you go, it's a shower. And I suddenly see that. One last example, famous one, this is a bonus example, one you probably heard about, the Native American Eskimos, who have lots of different words for snow because they have to. They have to be able to distinguish what kind of snow is safe for building, what kind is safe for walking, what kind is safe for melting, for drinking water, what kind betrays sign of gain, all those kinds of things. And unless you have words for those things, you don't see them, you don't survive. Okay? That was an example I was going to use. The mundane example is, I grew up around little lakes. So how many words for types of water do I know? I knew there was calm, choppy, and whitecaps. Okay, and you come out here to the ocean and people are talking about cat's paws, swells, tsunami, of course, the big tidal wave, all those kind of things. Any other wave words come to mind, you Northwesterners? Chop, of course. Point being, the hard version of this hypothesis says, unless you have a word, you cannot see it. The soft version of it says, unless you're conversant in it, you're not going to be conversant in it up here. You're not going to really understand what you're saying or doing with just as you move through your life. And I think the same is true of gender and our gendered identities and how we think and talk about those. Okay, so I just love to think about language as a soup, and that these two have something in common in that they're ways that we use language. And a way to think about language as a soup is to think about these are the ways that language also uses us, and that we are also sort of subject to the whims of language. I reach into the cupboard to get a cup, metaphorically. I'm reaching in to pick the perfect word, and I touch the word, you know, and it starts doing this, and I didn't expect it to do that. I thought I was just getting something that I had a handle on. So what I'd like, one point I'd like you to take from this is to recognize that we ought to have a lot of respect for the language that we use. And that's why. Here, when you think about communicating this language, if you think about language as a soup and you think about the actual act of languaging with other people, again, it's more than just sharing information. Roughly, you could say two things are happening. You're sharing a message, but you're also sharing messages about messages. Why am I talking to you this way? Why am I not talking to you like this? Hello. There are various ways of doing languaging. You might have some messages, and then you also have messages about messages. Now, is there a different message about a message in the way that I'm presenting this special information to you now? Would you like me to continue with this sort of meta message? No, I wouldn't like to do it either. It drives me crazy. But if you looked at it on paper, it looks like the same message, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay. We do so much stuff in our communication. And this is where a lot of those gendered messages start to appear. So if somebody says, if Emily says to me, it's your turn to put Tori to bed tonight. Well, she's saying to me, pretty straightforward, it's your turn to put Tori to bed tonight. What else is she saying?
And I don't plan to do it.
Okay, I don't plan to do it. What else?
And it's your turn.
Okay, well, that's pretty straightforward. It's my turn. That we try to be fair. I did last night.
Maybe you should get started doing it.
Maybe you should get started.
Probably wouldn't do it if you weren't told to.
Okay, I probably need to tell you this. That's part of our relationship. You do this kind of thing if I remind you. Now, all this, of course, depends on how I respond. If I say, oh, then that says something about I'm acquiescing to her view of our relationship and how all the meta messages that were attached to that message. But if I say, don't remind me, I know, which of course I always do, that says something else about my view of our relationship. So what I wanted to show you here is just four kinds of meta messages that are real common. And think about meta messages that maybe you've heard in relation to gender. What sorts of things are you told, verbally or non-verbally? You know what I mean by verbally and non-verbally? Verbally is with words, non-verbally is without words. So you could be non-verbal but still vocal. That's non-verbal, but it's still vocal. Okay, verbal is just with words. So we have meta messages, messages about the messages that have to do with the content. So I could walk up to you and go, ah, you're an ugly mug. Now, literally, what did I say?
I like him.
He's an ugly mug, literally. I said he's an ugly mug. But you say?
You like him.
Okay, how do you know?
Because it was a friendly, familiar approach you made to him.
Okay, so I did some nonverbal things that said, here's how you should interpret the literal meaning of this message. Okay? I'm joking. Right? Mm-hmm. Or if I came up and said, you are an ugly mug. Now that's different. They're all laughing. We still know this context. It's a teaching context, so you'd still probably conclude that I like this man, which I do, because he's larger than I am. But we have ways of saying things about the content. And have you ever done something where you think it was a nice nonverbal signal of how someone should read a message and they didn't get it? And then you had to say something like, I'm joking. Okay? So you had to move from the nonverbal to the verbal realm. And it's not like we do this on purpose. I'm doing it now, right? We also have verbal and nonverbal messages about the relationship. Verbal ones might be as, you know, straightforward as, I like you. Or, you know, just things like that. But this is where I think we just have a whole big, rich little line here. How do we nonverbally say things about our relationship? You know, how would it be different if I were talking to you like this, or if I were talking to you like this, you know, or if I were talking to you like this? All of these things. All of these things are nonverbal signals of the relationship I think I have with you. Okay, and your responses, of course, are your rejoinders, your negotiation with me. And it's not like this happens only in some communication. This happens in all communication. Okay, how many of you are touching the people that? Okay, even when you're silent, you're communicating with another person. You're aware of each other's presence. Why are you not conversing with one another? Is that something, you're saying something by not conversing with those around you about your relationship with me? Okay. How you'd like this to be? So this is something I just want to encourage you to think of language as this powerful thing, and that as we're ostensibly just sharing information with each other, what we're really doing is negotiating a whole bunch of stuff. We're negotiating, here's how you should hear this stuff I'm saying, and here's the relationship I think we have. I think I have the right to speak to you this way, and you're letting me. Okay. So there is some sort of relationship we're negotiating here. Last thing I want to highlight about this is that it's not something that happened to me in the past. It's something that we're doing right now. We're certainly informed by the things we bring with us, but that it's a matter of negotiating things that we're doing with each other. Last point. And this addresses some of, I think it's your, what's your name? Duluthman.
Paul.
Something Paul brought up yesterday about, well, you brought up again today. Heck with that, I'm not going to refer to yesterday, I'm going to refer to the day. Thinking about the links between communication and your, say, physiology, and how we are genetically set up to be, how we are chemically set up to be. And some of the most interesting studies I've seen lead me to this conclusion, that the quality of my communication really does affect the quality of my life. And I think most of us would grant that, you know, if you're socially competent, you probably have easier and more rich social interactions. A social life, this is a non-controversial claim, you'll have a different sort of social life if you have a certain quality of communication with the people in it. But that there are also actual physiological changes that result from different kinds of communication with people. And the studies I wanted to cite to you, I don't have them along, so I'm citing them from memory. I didn't expect to be talking about this, but this is just really a great opening. Thank you. One particular doctor has done several studies of identical twins, looking to see when these twins, well, they lead different lifestyles, first of all. Twins don't stay together generally their whole lives and do everything together. So there are some things that are genetically very similar about identical twins, and then what sorts of things do they do in their lives, and how can we explore those things? And the studies that most fascinated me were which of the twins reported having more satisfying lives and physiologically lived longer, had fewer diseases, and were just overall healthier, were people whose communication was of a sort where they had strong groups of friends and they spoke to them regularly. They had good, solid interpersonal connections in their lives. And people who died sooner, people who had poorer health, were people who were stuck in, or who placed themselves in isolation from other people and lived less well and less long, I guess, is one way to put it. And that hadn't occurred to me, that he's trying to make the point that communication actually gets into your bloodstream. That was his metaphor for it, was that the sort of interaction you choose to have with other people, the sorts of identities you negotiate with other people, really do get into your blood and change the person you are and you become. Some of the research in gender, to get back on the topic that you're here for, is that people who are more androgynous in their gendered identity, which is to say, it's not that you're neither masculine nor feminine, but that you have characteristics of both. And I've talked to several of you since yesterday who describe yourself in this way, share some of the same characteristics as of the people, I'm really stumbling here, of the people in that the study I just cited to you. If you are androgynous, you are more likely to be healthier, you're more likely to be satisfied with events in your life, and you're more likely to be socially competent, which I'm not being right now. I must be hanging in my masculine mode trying to tell you something. I'm sure what that is. But I'd like you to just sort of entertain this claim and think about it for a minute as we debrief what you've done on these lists. What I'd like is just the keeper of each list. Now I'm going to erase this stuff. Because what I want to hear are, let's see, I want to hear any words on either list that are animals. Who are the keepers of the list? Please raise your. There's one list and there's the other list. Let's start with the women's names for men. List off any that are animals.
Gorilla.
Okay. Nice subtle animal.
Colt, buck.
Colt, buck.
Colt and buck.
Okay.
Can we throw in snake? We just thought of that one.
Snake? You were on our list. But it's something I said. Go ahead.
P-I-D. Bastard, I guess.
Well.
And then there's son of a bitch.
Those are animals.
Yes.
Indirectly. Monster.
Sure. That's an animate thing.
I want to interject
something.
I want to interject that this paper shared a recent article about a gorilla that saved a baby that fell into its pit.
Yeah.
A mother gorilla.
Now, is that the prevailing view of gorillas? Do we think of gorillas as baby savers, or was that news? Men? Animals?
Chick, fox, cow, bitch.
Well, they're all complimentary.
Dame, dog, shrew.
You still looking?
No, that's it.
Okay. Now, what I want to do is look at these. Forget that these are lists of words for men and for women. And just tell me some differences between these two groups of animals. Any differences you can think of, I'll write them down over here. Over here.
Men are bigger.
Big and small.
Okay. So the words associated with men. Animals are big, these are small. What else do you see?
Frail and strong.
Which ones?
The females, frail.
Most of the women's are domestic.
Most of the women's are domestic. Are most of the men's wild?
Some of the men's terms are actually dangerous, potentially dangerous.
Yeah. Although some of these are also domestic, right?
Those are more dangerous.
Both violent and non-violent.
Okay, any of these violent?
Fox.
What is a fox? If a fox isn't violent, what's a better word?
Sly.
Cunning. Sly. So let me ask you a question that's related then. How would you characterize the intelligence of this group and that group? Not which is more intelligent, but what words would you associate with the intelligence of these?
None and plenty.
Be more specific than none and plenty. How would you describe? In what way is a snake smart? In what way is a pig smart? In what way is a stud smart? A gorilla smart? In what way is a chick smart, a bitch smart, a dog smart, a shrew smart?
Well, they're smart. They have to be clever.
Some of those female ones are manipulative.
They're manipulative smart, cunning smart, sly smart. You're speaking too, I'm sorry.
That's what I was saying. They have to be clever to get their food to hide. to hide and do whatever.
And to prey.
More clever than the others. The others are kind of. They're there to stay out of their way.
You're talking about men now? Instinctual smart?
Yeah.
Others? I'm going to add quite a few adjectives here until we get it covered. Instinctual smartness.
Brute force.
A couple of them on that side are predatory, whereas none of the women's are.
Oh, interesting.
Frogs, I guess. Not in the way snakes and monster are. I mean, sort of poisonous. And
how about if I make it not a real dichotomy and say predatory and less predatory? Let's stop there. Look at these two for now. And next I'm going to ask you for a list of foods, if you've got any foods on there. But when you look at these two things, and now remember again that they are words that we use that are intelligible to us, that apply to men and women, what does this language say to you about how we see men and how we see women in the language that we apply? I mean, these aren't words you use necessarily, but they are words that make sense to you. That if I erase the words, in fact, I'll do that. If I erase the words on the left with the same paper towel that's probably been in here since February, and instead we look at this, what does that tell you? If you think of language as a soup, if you think of language as something that does something to us as well as we do something to it, here's what we're doing to us. When we talk about it, I talk about man as big, strong, dangerous, instinctual, forceful, direct, and somehow predatory. Does that seem too out of line? Does that seem pretty accurate if you look at this view of man? I look at women as pretty small, frail, pretty domestic. If they're smart, they're clever, they're cunning. They don't come right out and say it. They sort of, you let them think they're doing it, and then, you're actually doing it. Less predatory. They're more likely to be victims than victimizers. Emily's flashing fingers at me saying that we don't have enough time to do the food thing.
Don't write it down.
You want to do it?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. What do you have, men? Food things?
Honey.
Sweetie.
Sweetie.
Real filling so far.
Peach.
Peach?
Yeah, it wasn't on our list, but that's a good one.
Sugar.
Anybody say cookies? Sweet. Cookies, sweetie.
We were not big on foods.
Are any of those a meal? Any of those filling?
No.
Could you live on any of those?
No. Wouldn't want to, that filling.
Red-haired person?
Stud muffin.
I always want to know what that is. Not necessarily eat one, but I'm just really curious what a stud muffin is.
Beefcake.
Sugar daddy.
Milk toast. Cupcake. Bonehead.
Red winner.
How about pumpkin?
Pumpkin. I've got little kids' pumpkin. That's a harder one. This isn't as bifurcated as the animal one was for me. This one's a harder one to see, which is probably to your credit.
It is interesting, though, too, and it's not only in what we said, though, it's how we're also attaching extra meaning as we do the interpreting, and so we're actually even more polarizing the statement as we go through the interpretation. For instance, when sugar daddy, I would think, is kind of a sweet thing, but the way you said it back to the class as sugar daddy.
Sugar daddy.
You know, it's also, we even polarize it more as we think about it.
But I don't think sugar daddy had a good connotation.
Sugar daddy is one who subsidizes the lifestyle of his mistress, so he can have her available for sex.
I was thinking those little caramel things.
That's true. That's just as true. That's another one. Point here being simply that unless you buy the notion that something comes along with our language, none of this really matters very much. It's like, oh, this is interesting, it's fun, we can put whatever interpretation we want on them, and we do to some degree, but we also are affected by these kinds of things in our talk
and
in our gender thing. Yes, please do.
When Jeff and I were talking about doing this and we talked about this exercise, I had some real misgivings about it because I said, I was hoping that where we were going to aim for our week was to find ways to not be so polarized, to find ways to look at gender as not something that's so divisive and that we draw this serious line down. And what, yeah, and this exercise really sort of points out where we've done that with our language and in our thinking and in our, and sort of in our viscerally. I mean, I wouldn't want to be called many of the things that were named, and I wouldn't, you know, on either list. And so I think that that was a challenge for me, and we talked that through. But, you know, the idea that you're right, I mean, what this does is really shows us how polarizing our language is. And I think that that's an okay example as long as we all keep in mind that that's the power. I mean, bottom line, it's scary to even do exercises sometimes, or what you're going to do is really accentuate it. So
I want to finish by saying one more thing and asking you a question. And the thing I want to say is something I've just forgotten. Oh, that this will be the most polarizing day you'll have this week in the session. That we want to do one day of this, because people like man versus woman kind of thing, and this is a nice way to do it and to make a point at the same time. And that what we're going to be doing from here on out is to try and do less of that and try and do more masculine and feminine together rather than apart. So
this should be a nice
say.
Evening for all of us. This should be a nice evening for all of us.
I'm really hoping. Remember, our goal is to start a lot more conversation than we did.
And we decided we wouldn't tell people which was our Shelley number.
Shelley 6, I think, is where we're living. Shelley 6. My name is Martin Wells. The thing I wanted to ask you was, and I don't know that we should actually take time to talk about it here, but what do you think should be taken out of this today, given all the stuff that we've done and talked about today? Sources of messages we get about gendering and the means by which those messages come to us in all of our little mundane everyday conversations. We're saying so much to each other, and we are negotiating and joining with each other about so much stuff. What do you think you should take away from this thing? I'd love to hear from several of you during the day about what you think
you
should take away.
It's how you say it.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. And 3 more sessions this week. Tomorrow's is also at this time slot in this room.
Thanks.
Thank you.